Well, I didn't expect that.
Are you talking about reaction to our first episode?
I am. It's gone so much better than I ever thought it would. Let me just read you, Helen, some of the Patreon comments here. Bron says, loved the first episode. I've always enjoyed listening to Helen, but this is a great pairing. Frank says, that was fantastic. Just what I've been hoping the team would produce. Patricia says, I just listened to the first episode. I like a podcast that educates me, but not so in-depth that I find it difficult to follow. And I have to say, this was perfect, says Patricia. Just the right length of time for me. A great mix of interesting topics. I smiled the entire time. Well done. I've added it to my list on Spotify. That's what we want to hear, Patricia. Thank you. And let me just bring you this. Finally, from Michelle, who says, just listened to the first new podcast. It was full of fascinating new information. Lovely to hear from Stuart. Think he should be in every episode. Well, hold that thought, Michelle. Hold that thought. How often will these be released and when is the next one? Many thanks for yet more ways to enjoy Time Team.
Well, those are such kind and lovely comments. I'm so glad you all enjoyed it. And I think the mix of things is really important to me too. I really like variety. Oh, and Michelle, you asked how often they'll be released. Well, we're doing them once a fortnight at the moment. And the next episode is right now. Welcome to the Time Team podcast.
Yes, welcome to another Time Team podcast. I'm Martin Williams, and alongside me is Time Team's Dr. Helen Geek.
We'll have more from people on Patreon a little later, because if you support us there, you had the chance to ask us anything you like about archaeology, about history, or about Time Team itself. We'll end each podcast with your questions, and we've had loads of responses, which we'll go through later.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I like quizzing you, Helen. In fact, I might do it now. What have you been up to recently?
Oh, what you mean in my day job with fines? Well,
I like proof that you're an archaeologist.
I actually do something with the rest of my time. Yeah. Well, I've been tussling with another of those difficult Latin inscriptions. It's been keeping me awake at night. I get these every now and then, and this one is on the inside of a gold finger ring, and it's of Tudor date, 16th century. And although we can read it, it's really clear, and we think we know what each word means, we don't know what the whole thing, the whole text means. It could be a quotation from the Bible, but we haven't found it yet, or it could be a classical author like Ovid or Virgil, or it could even have been made up by the owner. It could be an original composition. So I think I might have to put this one on social media and see if the rest of the world has got any ideas. This is where the hive mind of everybody across the whole world really helps.
I love the mystery of it as well, and the idea that somebody has created this mystery so long ago, and only now are you starting to even try and unravel it. We need more of this, I think. Well, good luck with that, but you have another job to do right now, and that's to do this podcast, because also in this episode, you're going to hear part two of my chat with Time Team's creator, Tim Taylor, and I'm on a mission as well to learn a little bit more about what archaeology actually involves. So I've been to a very soggy hillside in Wiltshire to meet John, who operates the Big Digger. So all of that is to come. What should we talk about first, though, Helen?
I find it amazing when a huge archaeological site turns up in the kind of area that you've been investigating for years, decades, centuries. Places like those places around major universities. We all know that Cambridge and Oxford have been universities for centuries. They've had archaeology departments for a long time. They've had curious people working there and going out and looking at the landscape around. So you'd think that Cambridgeshire and Oxfordshire would be two of the most intensively studied counties that there are. Oxfordshire particularly is packed full of everything. It's got prehistory, it's got early Anglo-Saxon cemeteries, it's got deserted medieval villages, it's got everything. But what has been absolutely extraordinary to my mind is the news that an entire Roman villa has been hiding near Wantage for, ever since the end of the Roman Empire. And it has recently been unearthed on a new housing development. It's just absolutely extraordinary.
I just love this sort of thing. There it is, hiding in plain sight, and you need a housing development to discover it. Let's find out what has been discovered then. Francesca Giarelli is from Red River Archaeology. And Francesca, you've been getting your hands dirty, haven't you? You've been very busy.
Yeah, we've been quite busy on this site. We were quite surprised to find a villa that no one had idea was here since, yeah, probably the end of the Roman time.
So, Francesca, can you take us through how that kind of, how it works? I mean, what investigation did you do when the planning application first came in? How the standard evaluation techniques, aren't there? Standard ways in which you try to predict what you might find when you first put trowel to earth or digger to earth to strip the topsoil off. What did we try throwing at this and not find that Roman villa?
After any planning permission, there are two phases of exploration: a non-invasive exploration that will involve radar, geophysics and lidars, and then an invasive procedure that will involve trenching, usually trial trenching. So we put holes in the ground, small one, and see what comes up. Both of these failed to find out that there was three buildings here.
Even the trial trenching,
for some sort of bed of good luck, they were not put on top of the buildings. So they realized there was one corn dryer, but they didn't catch any of the other walls and foundations.
So if you kind of handed back to the developers saying, we don't think there's anything there, then at what point do you realize that there is a villa there?
Because they wanted the area anyway, we realized that there was a villa the moment we start the open excavation of that area. We removed the little vegetation that there was, the first 5 centimeters of topsoil, and the wall started appearing.
Amazing. Just describe then what you've actually found now. What does it look like if I was to turn up on site? What would I see?
So at the moment you will see a vast area covered in what is wall foundations. So we can recognize three different buildings. So we have a ailed corridor building, an ailed building, and another corridor villa.
Do you think they're all link up to make one complex, or do you think that one succeeds another when the first goes out of use?
We know that the ale building comes after the corridor villa. We don't know the third one because it's a bit separate, so it's difficult to interpret how they relate to each other. They might as well have been there from the beginning. There is a continuity of use, but we don't know if that part of the building has always been up while the ale building was running.
And from the photographs, it looked like there was a very small overburden. You know, it was right just underneath the surface. How deep is the stratigraphy that you've got?
Our stratigraphy at the moment goes for about 60 centimetres, meaning that the lowest foundation are 60 centimetres from the surface.
So it was hiding there in plain sight.
Yes, but obviously quite a lot of it.
All of it, basically, yeah.
That's a truly amazing thing. And how much Roman activity is there in the vicinity?
Quite a lot. We obviously, following the housing development, we excavate basically all the fields around the villa. And we found a very extensive field system. So there are lots and lots of ditches crossing each other, forming very nice, ordinate little rectangular parchment of land, basically.
Even though you knew that there was a lot of Roman activity in the area, obviously this has come as a bit of a shock. How surprised were you, though, by the scale of what you found?
We were very surprised. It's difficult to imagine, with all the preparation that comes before us opening an area, that there was no mention it all. We went through even the old survey map, and none of them mentioned there was maybe a stones. They usually have names that can be related to location, and they give you a hint that there might be a building there, but in this case there was absolutely nothing.
It reminds me slightly of the villa that we've been working on with Time Team right at the other end of Oxfordshire in Broughton, because that also was not known about, but that was under quite a lot of overburden, and the farmer had been aware that there was a building there. He had just assumed that it was Victorian. But to have something that is completely unknown, and to have more than, it's not the only one, is what I'm trying to say, I suppose. Having this one that we have been working on with Time Team shows that this can happen and is happening across the country. So we shouldn't ever feel that everything's been discovered or there's nothing huge left to find. Archaeology can always surprise us, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. For as much as the technology has advanced, evidently is not perfect yet. It cannot predict everything. Even the LiDAR failed, and it usually picks up quite a lot.
Francesca, before we let you go, the one thing that I find sad about these stories when something amazing is discovered on something like a housing development site. How frustrating is it for you as an archaeologist, as somebody who's working on this amazing site, that eventually you're going to have to, what, cover it back over and then let them get back to building houses? I mean, it seems such a shame that the people who eventually live there maybe won't be able to see the extent of this amazing bit of history right underneath their dining room or something.
It's always a bit of a bittersweet sensation. Like, obviously, without the development, we would not have had the chance to discover the villa. In the other side as well, like, archaeology is always a bit of distraction. If we wanted to know more about this building, we would have eventually had to demolish parts of them. Thankfully, we can produce recording that will last forever, and like, everyone will be able eventually to see that. I hope it won't be forgotten again.
Well, let's hope so, for goodness sake. You can't lose it twice. That'd be a nightmare. Yeah.
I think it will be well preserved by being replaced by the record. So the report will always be available for people to read.
Francesca, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you to have me here, and it was a pleasure.
Now, the more I think about doing this podcast, Martin, the more excited I get because of all those discoveries we'll be able to bring to people's attention. Now, you'll know that Time Team has been carrying out excavations at Sutton Hoo over the summer, and we've been recording loads of things there. But our microphones have also been following the Operation Nightingale project, and that recently has been throwing up some particularly interesting finds. So make sure you hit follow now so you never miss an episode of the Time Team podcast.
Do it, do it, do it. Now, you may have also seen that Time Team's launched our new 15,000 member target on Patreon. We're hoping, fingers crossed, to get there by the end of 2025. If we can do that, and it is an ambitious aim, it'll allow us to investigate more sites, produce more episodes, and expand into other areas as well. And your support on Patreon is absolutely vital to allow us to continue to do that work that we're doing for archaeology and education.
Yeah, and we've also announced that archive episodes from Series 19 will soon be coming to the Time Team Classics YouTube channel. So head there and hit subscribe for more. And there's more information on so many of our plans for the future in the YouTube video called Big News. So go and give that one a watch too.
Okay, let's get back to the archaeology now. Helen, you, I imagine, are very used to kind of crawling around on a wet field on your hands and knees with a trowel in your hand. But this is very much new territory for me. And I've been really interested to kind of learn about the archaeological process, you know, how you go about identifying a site and then digging it and what you discover there. So once you know where your spade's going, you can get a little bit of help to start things off from the mechanical digger. Now, I'm very excited about this. I love a massive machine. So I went to a windswept field near Devizes to meet John Beaver and his big yellow trowel.
Hey, John, can I come up here? Or let me just... Got the tunes going, have you?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Hey, I like this. This is great. This is an enormous machine. What am I standing on the side of?
It's a 20-ton cat. It's a monster, this one.
Can I see it in action?
Of course you can, yeah.
The arm is going up. It's so huge, this. I'm standing right next to the bucket now, and it's got to be at least, what, 3-4 times my height? Something like that. Huge, big, yellow chunk of metal. This is a meaty thing.
Obviously, when you're doing archaeology, you've got to do everything a lot more delicately. So it's a case of taking off topsoil first in thin layers. Then you'll come down to your subsoil. You'll take the subsoil down in small layers until you reach the archaeology. With a big machine like this, it's a lot of precision and a lot of time, a lot of gentle strokes with it.
Oh, it's high. We're looking at the huge scoop on the front of the digger. It's so massive, yet how precise do you have to be with it?
So the scoop on the front is called a grading bucket. This is the one that archaeologists mainly use because the other ones come with teeth. So that's no good in archaeology. The precision when you're taking down the layers, you'll take the topsoil off first. Then you've got to go down to the topsoil, the subsoil. You know, it could be 2 mil of subsoil. Then again, it could be a foot. The strokes that you take on it and the positioning of the bucket on the ground, if you take too much and put too much pressure on it, you'll take all the archaeology away. Then it's a waste of time doing what you're doing. But even with this big 20 tonner, if you've been on them for quite a while, you know the archaeology, you can see it. When you're on archaeology, everything's so much slower, so much more delicate, and you really got to be switched on. I mean, I go home sometimes with a ramping headache where you're concentrating so much on the ground.
But you do get a bit of a knack for it then, to spotting it really just by the feel and just by the look of the soil.
The grounds, yeah, you can tell a lot. I mean, that's like a third arm, that is. When I'm pulling across, you can feel the ground change, the soft spots, the subsoil. That's the most important bit.
What's the most common thing you hear from archaeologists that you're working with?
Can you take an inch, another inch?
And do you think they realise how difficult that is to do?
I think they do know that, you know, we're here, this is what I do. So they know what they ask for is what I give them.
Can I sit in the big seat?
Of course you can.
Let's get back in out of the wind.
Yeah.
I'm in. Right, what buttons can I press, John?
Do you want to start it? So if you turn that button there.
Okay.
That's it.
It's alive!
Right, if I turn this down a little bit, this is the revs. So if you drop this dead man down.
Okay, that's that switch there.
If you pull that back.
Okay, I'm pulling the left joystick
nice and
back. Very gently. Oh!
Okay.
Yeah, right. It's moving towards me. God, you really do feel like you're in charge of a big old bit of machinery, don't you?
Yeah, this is my big yellow trowel.
Yes. Wow. Well, I've enjoyed that. And finally, John, can I toot the horn?
Of course you can. It's that one there.
It's so precise, yet so powerful, isn't it? I remember years ago when we still did temporary backfilling over black plastic, the kind of thing that bin bags are made out of. You could be watching a machine take a backfill away and they would leave the plastic clean, but they wouldn't tear it. It was absolutely millimetre accuracy. I did once have a play on a digger years ago when I was working at Flag Fen with Francis Pryor. Now, he's a really expert digger driver and he doesn't mind letting other people have a go. But I felt it was nearly impossible. You needed at least three hands. You need to keep all of those joints working together to maintain a flat angle on the bucket edge. And as you pull it back, I ended up digging these kind of unfortunate divots in the surface that I was trying to aim at. I mean, you just basically need a lot of physical coordination. It is not an easy thing to do at all.
No, and all I was doing was starting it up and making the front bucket go forward, and I found that difficult enough. So you got a real sense, and it's so big as well. Certainly the one I was on, it's so massive, and you just think, how on earth can you get that huge thing to respond in such a minute way?
Yeah, and you just don't know how difficult anybody's job is until you try to do it, do you?
That is a really good point, and I'll remind you of that the next time I'm editing this podcast, Helen. That's what I'll say.
Now, I know I'm awful at setting up a microphone. I can't even do that.
It's a work in progress. Now, you might remember in the last episode you heard from Time Team's landscape archaeologist, Stuart Ainsworth. Now, Stuart is back next time, actually, to tell you about LIDAR and, you know, how that works and how it can help archaeologists before they put their hand anywhere near a trowel. Well, I've been romping across a field to learn more.
So, why don't you get down on the ground now? Come on.
Okay, I'm here.
I'm lying flat on the ground. One does in the
It's wet down here.
It's wet, yeah, right. Now, look, there's a ridge on top of the ridge, but that ridge is now running away from us. That's the kind of detail that you start to look for as a landscape archaeologist.
Yeah, I got very damp, Helen.
But that's exactly the kind of hands-on archaeology experience, or at least flatten your front archaeology experience, that you should be having. That's the ideal way to learn. And don't forget, any of us can do it any time when out and about in the countryside. You're not having a lie down. You're doing important archaeological research on ancient earthworks. But I suppose if you can't get out and about, or if you're many miles away from the place that you're interested in, you can still get involved because you can use LiDAR to look at landscape features from the comfort of your own chair.
Yeah, so I have been learning, and you can hear Stuart's comprehensive guide to LiDAR, you know, what it is, how it works, and most importantly, how it can help archaeologists reveal the secrets of a landscape in the next episode.
Right, back now to Martin's interview with the creator of Time Team, Tim Taylor. In the last episode, you heard about what Tim had been doing before Time Team and how he met Mick Aston, whose archaeological knowledge inspired him to pitch it to Channel 4. And luckily for Tim, he'd already been doing a bit of work for the broadcaster, which had been going quite well.
We were making 4 or 5 documentaries called Time Signs. Channel 4 liked it, and they kept saying, oh, go on, then let's have another one as the waters rose. As this process developed, I also began to think about a treatment where you describe to someone what's going to happen. And it was like a team of people. We throw them into a site. They've got all the equipment and all the help they need. And they've got 3 days to answer some critical questions about that site. We ended up doing a pilot in Dorchester, and you could feel that it was exciting. So I ended up creating this format document, taking it to Channel 4, and they said, well, we think there really is something in this. And they said, yes, I think we're going to do this. And that was the beginning of Time Team.
And what did that feel like when that yes finally came?
Well, it was amazing, really, because it was one of those moments. I vaguely remember, I got the information. I had a piece of classical music, a piece of Tchaikovsky on at the time. And I remember turning up the volume and having a little dance and going, yes.
Do you remember which one it was?
I can probably sing it to you. 1812 Overture. And it had that moment of elation about it. We'd really been hanging on for a year. I'd put a lot of money into the pilot in Dorchester, and we then didn't get an answer. So the business was hanging on by its toenails at that stage. I remember going to lots of conversations with the bank in which we had to discuss the overdraft we were running. And I knew that the bank manager was very interested on fishing expeditions. So I used to say to him, did you have a good fishing expedition? And he'd smile and talk about that for about an hour. And by the end of it, he'd forgotten what I was there to talk about. We survived in that way. But to hear that was marvelous. And I remember moments when I went up to Channel 4, like the big office, you know, I'd come up from the West Country and there I'd be, this huge, wonderful looking building. And I had moments when one or two very, very kind people sort of saw something about Time Team. And I remember saying to them at the time, you realize we may not find something. We'll put all this money in to make a film, and I can't guarantee you at the end that we'll actually come up with something, because literally we don't know what is under the ground. We do a lot of research, but you can never tell what's going to come up. They seemed to go for that, which I think shows a lot of credit to them, that they were willing to take a risk, although in those days I think they were more interested in taking risks with programs. So there we had it. Before I went up to there, I said to Mick, I think this is really good. And Mick, in his Brummy accent, said, it'll never happen, Tim. It'll never happen. And it was amazing. And we did the pilot, and we enjoyed the pilot. And I said to Mick, don't worry about the cameras. You just do the archaeology, and we'll follow you. Then we had a marvelous cameraman called Nick Dance, who had the ability to sort of follow everything with a camera on Steadicam with very few cuts, very few edits. And that gave the program a kind of rhythm, a kind of energy that we were following what was happening. It wasn't all set up and predictable.
Tim Taylor there. Now, next time you're going to hear what happened when Tony Robinson joined Time Team.
Well, I don't know how you got Tim to divulge that the commission of Time Team led him to dance around to Tchaikovsky.
It's quite the image, isn't it?
Yes, they say radio has the best images. And I certainly got a vivid one from that. But I think, you know, I think Tim's right about Channel 4's tolerance of risk at the time. Because the received opinion in broadcasting, I think, had always been that archaeology programmes had to be about the results because the process was so unpredictable. But Channel 4, in those early days, it was all about being different. And they saw that it was the process, it was the unpredictability and the authenticity that was important. And that people were just as interested in seeing how we'd come to the conclusions as the conclusions themselves.
Right, we're almost at the end of the podcast now. And, well, it's time for questions. And thank you so much if you've got in touch on Patreon. You do need to go to Patreon. Please do it. If you haven't already supported us there, please do it. It is your opportunity on Patreon to interact with the podcast. You go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial. And if you go there, you will be able to ask questions to Helen. And you can ask her anything you like. It could be something to do with a particular episode of Time Team that you may have watched. It could be something to do with an archaeological process you don't know about. Or maybe you just want to know what Tony Robinson's like. You can ask anything you want, and we'll try and get you answers at the end of each episode. So, Helen, are you ready for this? Because I've got some questions for you here now from people who've been listening to the first episode.
I'm bracing myself, yes.
Okay, well, the first question comes from Sam Batston, who says, how do you get to understand different strap ends? I remember when you blew Tony's mind on that. Now, firstly, you're going to need to explain what strap ends are, Helen, because I don't really know what Sam's talking about.
Right. Well, this is the strap ends are a thing that weights down the end of your belt or strap. I mean, I think most of them are used on belts, sword straps, the kind of thing that go around your middle. First of all, they weight down the end so that it dangles in an interesting way. And secondly, they stop the strap unravelling if it's made of textile. Something that people in the past did a lot was they had decorative plates that fixed onto their buckle loops. These couldn't be seen if the strap was continuing around the waist. So they wanted it to dangle down and reveal this plate. And it's a thing that lasts for centuries and centuries. The strap end is necessary for that to weight it down. You start off by looking at the majority. You look at the most common ones. And there's two lots of most common ones. There's the late Anglo-Saxon ones on the one hand, and then you skip forwards over maybe half a millennium, and then they become really common again in the medieval period, in the 14th century. And the construction of each one is different. So the late Anglo-Saxon ones are either cast in one piece or they're pretending to be. And then the later medieval ones are made from lots of flat sheets of metal held together by solder and rivets. So that's the first thing. You look at how they're made. Then the second thing is one of the really biggest clues on the posher ones is that you look at their art styles. They're really recognisable. And so you think to yourself, well, I can see it's a strap end. It's got a split end to hold the strap. It's got this art style, so I know where I am. So you identify your art style, and then you've got your date. Then you skip over to the 14th century, and we get hardly any decoration. It's just like a smooth, polished surface with maybe a zigzag on it. Now, those are really common as well. And what's really frustrating is that we can only date them roughly to the 14th century. Those are the most common ones. You will just have to stop me if you're, because I'm now going to go on to the Roman ones.
Oh my goodness, I had no idea.
Bet you wish you hadn't asked this question.
No, I don't at all. I never thought that this could be so interesting.
No, but then you get into the Roman ones, and Roman strap ends can be really difficult because they look, well, they're Romanesque. And the other point at which a Romanesque style was in use was in the Norman period. So you've got strap ends with much the same art styles, which are in use 1,000 years apart. So you have to try to find some way of sorting those out, and it can be really, really difficult. The buckle is one of the things that the Romans invented, and we don't know that. You know, we know to thank them for roads and central heating and piped water. We also need to thank them for the buckle.
Well, Sam, I think I would argue here that the answer that you just got there is worth your Patreon subscription alone, because that was so comprehensive. And I will never think about belts and look at a belt in the same way ever again. Now I know about strap-ins. That was so interesting. Okay, well, that was question one.
I promise I won't be as lengthy on any other.
Okay, well, let's have another one here. This is from Steve. Steve Micra, I think I'm saying your surname, M-I-K-R-E, Steve Micra, who says, I always wondered if any of the children of the Time Team cast grew up and pursued a career in archaeology as well.
Ooh, that's a really good question. Well, you do get dynasties in archaeology, but I don't think that we've got any among Time Team members. I'm racking my brains. Now, Carenza's daughter is a history teacher, so she's obviously got the same passion for the past and the passion for communicating, and it's come out in a slightly different and possibly more secure career path. But I don't think there's anybody else yet that's joined the ranks of archaeologists.
On the broadcasty side, on the media-y side, Tim, who is the creator of Time Team, several members of his family do bits and bobs, don't they, for Time Team itself and within the media industry. So there's maybe a sort of thing there, but that's the other side of it, really, isn't it?
Well, we tend to drag people in whatever they do, because that's archaeology all over. So there are a couple of children of Time Team members, one of Stuart's children and one of Mick's children, who've gone to medical school. And of course, anybody who's a doctor is always eagerly seized upon for an explanation of why somebody in a grave might be buried with something because they've had a disease in life or something. It's the lived experience of the person whose bones we're looking at that a doctor is really useful for. Because an osteologist is one particular thing, but a doctor sees an illness or an injury or a genetic variant in their doctor's surgery alive, so that they provide the link from the bones to life. So whenever a doctor or a nurse arrives on a Time Team site that's to do with burials, they're usually put to work. In fact, rarely does a visitor turn up who isn't put to work, because everything, every piece of life experience is mirrored in the past, and therefore we want to know everybody's experience because it helps us understand the lives of the people that we're digging up, if you see what I mean.
So Steve, the answer, the short answer is no, but that doesn't mean that they're not useful regardless of what they do and used. Exactly. Okay, one final question here, and it comes from Gloria B. Mick Aston emphasised involving children and answering their questions. What can children and their parents do to get involved with archaeology and with Time Team? Gloria, it's exactly the sort of question we want to answer, really, isn't it?
It is, yes. And I think the key here is that archaeology is all about decoding things and finding clues. And everybody likes decoding things and finding clues, and children as much as anybody else. One of the things I did with my children when they were small, because we always wanted to go around castles and stately homes and that kind of thing, which all had a link back to fighting in the past. And we would give them each a sword, and then they'd race around pretending to fight and also working out what the best lookout points were and places where they could hide and ambush the rest of the family. So that's for children that like fighting, which in my experience tends to be most of them. But it's a way of getting them to think about a building, and they don't even realise that they are thinking about it. Country walks also can be turned to your advantage, particularly if yours like finding things like animal bones. I mean, I'd admit that can be a bit of a smelly hobby, I mean, particularly when you load them back into the car and you don't realise quite how fresh they are. But it is really fun to see. I know, horrible. Sometimes you've carried around half a sheep for a while and then realise when you get it back to the car that you can't
just
possibly
be you,
load it
you
in.
Know. I think it could
possibly.
Just, yeah.
but I think it's fun to work out which bit of the animal's which and why does it look like that, particularly with skulls, because they tell you so much about the animal. Because we don't live too far from the East Anglian coast, we've got a seal skull that we found recently and an owl skull at home, which are absolutely brilliant and exciting things. But we've also got about 10 boxes of rabbit and badger bones, and that they're not quite so fascinating. But it's a good way of starting. And of course, people who can identify animal bones, like Naomi, they're always in huge, huge demand, because animal bones are one of the commonest finds on archaeological sites. And if you don't have that expertise, they can all look a bit the same. I think really, though, the most important thing, the most important tool for an archaeologist is probably your imagination. If you read great novels, great historical and time travel novels, you can really get your imagination in gear and working well. And I tend to think that all archaeologists are frustrated travellers in time. We try, and we don't quite manage it. So I found that if you like reading to your children, and who doesn't, Tom's Midnight Garden, for instance, A Traveller in Time, all those time travel books, they're wonderful for the romantics among us. They're good reads with children. They're good reads for children on their own. I think also, I mean, I've only recently read A Traveller in Time for the first time. I think they're good reads for adults. They're not just to be given to children. So read and wake up your brain. Engaging with Time Team, well, of course, the best way is to become a Patreon, isn't it?
Oh, because you very get good. So very much. On brand. Very on brand. Very nice.
Well, it's true, though, because it's not just funding an archaeological project from a distance. You can actually get involved.
You absolutely can. Gloria, I hope that answers your question. And thank you so much. If you did submit one, if you asked one but you didn't hear it on this episode, then fear not, because I'm collating all the ones that we didn't get time to use, and we might do a special kind of question and answer episode at some point in the future. I'd love more, actually, for the next episode. Remember, you have to be a Patreon member to ask a question, so do head over there now. You can either comment on any of the podcast-related posts that you see with your question, or just send us a direct message. However you do it, you know, we'll see it, and we'll get you an answer. Patreon.com/timeteamofficial is where you need to go.
And that's about it for this episode. Next time, we're going to find out more about LIDAR with Stuart Ainsworth, and that will be something that's interesting for everybody, because it's a tool that everybody can use as long as you've been trained by the great Stuart Ainsworth himself. So we're looking forward to that. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next time on the Time Team podcast.
Bye.